Why should we grope among the dry bones of the past? The sun shines today also. Let us demand our own works, our own worship. Why, in an altered age, do we worship in the dead forms of our forefathers? Ralph Waldo Emerson was 33 when these words sprang off the pages of his publication, Nature. It was 1836, and he just left the Unitarian ministry, frustrated by what he felt was its over-allegiance to tradition and its unwillingness to adapt for a new age. These 177 years later, the Unitarian Church, in the form of the Unitarian Universalist Association, survives. And still we hear from some corners the same critique that Emerson made to the church of his day, from those who often struggle to find themselves at home in our Sunday services. One of my peers in seminary, she was a young adult who was raised a Unitarian Universalist. She described to me how she'd spent her Sundays growing up in children's chapel, and then in YRUU, where she experienced all kinds of rituals and songs and emotionally engaged and personally relevant worship. And then she became an adult and found that the Sunday service of her home church looked an awful lot like the least updated Protestant service out there. Hymns that drag on, she said. Intellectually distant sermons on topics that didn't have much bearing on growing up today. And standing up and sitting down for no apparent reason. Responsive readings that could only be described as lifeless. Why should we grope among the dry bones of the past? Why, in an altered age, do we worship in the dead forms of our forefathers? Rebecca Parker tells the story of when she first moved to California to become the president of our Unitarian Universalist Seminary, the Star King School for the Ministry. She says, "Truth be told, I was feeling proud of myself. Captain of my ship and master of my soul, I had valiantly charted my course to become first a cellist, and then a minister, and now an educator." She says when she first arrived, she had discovered that she had a bunch of distant cousins who lived nearby, cousins she'd never met. These cousins decided that to welcome her, they should have a kind of family reunion at one of their homes. So on the day of the reunion, she pulled in the driveway and saw there the various bumper stickers. One said, "If you want peace, work for justice." Another, "Teachers do it with class." Another, "Live music is best." And then there was one that said, "If you love Jesus, tithe." Thank you. Tithe, right. Our stewardship committee can explain that one to you. Don't know. So inside, she describes meeting each of her cousins one by one. Here was Sally, a minister of religious education and graduate of Pacific School of Religion. And here was Mike, a professional French horn player and high school music teacher. And then Eldon, who was a seminary dean. And then David, a United Methodist parish minister. Every single one of her distant cousins, she said, was a musician, a minister, or a teacher. And several were all three. Not only that, the ministers were all liberal, social activist types with an intellectual bent, and all the musicians were classical. Apparently, she says, I had never made any choices at all. My life was given to me. I did not make myself. And this is how it is. We receive who we are before we choose who we will become. Before seminary, I worked as the director of an in-home care agency where I oversaw 7 district offices. One of those offices, from the time we opened it until the time I left, really struggled. Last I checked in, like about a year ago, it was still struggling. The first manager there, though she initially seemed trustworthy, quickly revealed herself as negative and pretty dishonest. So about 2 years into her employment, we let her go. It was a hard termination, and I still remember how hurt she sounded. Now, admittedly, by then, her three employees, they were equally negative and hard to work with, just plain grouchy. But we thought, okay, well, let's just see how they do with a new manager. You can guess, right? They never recovered. And we had to let them go shortly thereafter. But by then, the new manager we'd hired had caught the bug too, so we had to let her go too. So we decided to start from scratch. I sent what I thought was my especially strong and positive manager from another office to hire a new team, which she did, prioritizing employees with apparent positive attitudes and references that described them as especially honest. So before long, we were feeling pretty good. The office was meeting its goals, and the best improvement of all, everyone was really nice. But then, a year later, we were audited. And in the process of trying to prepare, we discovered that each of these positive, honest employees had taken up the practice of filing all their state-required paperwork in the trunks of their cars. Boxes of paperwork, just sitting there, because filing it for real would reveal that they were nowhere near those goals that we had thought they'd been blazing through. Despite the fact that none of these employees had ever even met the prior employees, somehow they had taken up the same patterns. As Rebecca Parker says, even when we do not directly know the people whose lives are linked with ours, our lives unfold in relationship with theirs. It is as if in the walls, these patterns we step into, in the air, in the soil, in the trees, in the stars, we are born into patterns that we had no part in creating. Whenever you walked into this church for the first time, you fell into the middle of a story already unfolding. There are traditions and ways of working, ways of interacting that are in this church's DNA. What are those things? Or at least, which of these things do we explicitly claim? This is where I get to read some of your answers. I can't get to all of them, but I promise I will publish them, either, maybe even both, the extra and the intercom. The ones from the first service were fabulous, hilarious, great, and interesting. Okay, here we are. Announcements, sad face. Closing song, happy face. Right, these are our traditions. Pumpkin carving, happy face. Cake auction, happy face. Sharing joys and concerns, happy face. Ringing chimes to begin the service, happy face. The change for change offering, happy face. Right? Remember, so as you're listening, think about, like, are these things you would call tradition? And if this is your same reaction, happy, sad. Lighting the chalice, big, smiley, happy face. Sunday service and religious education, happy face. Wow, this is a big list. Church auction, happy face. Spirit singers, happy face. It's a tradition. Nice. That we grumble about our space, sad face. Inclusiveness, happy face. A lot of singing, oh, it's a kind of a grouchy face. A couple more. Lighting the chalice, happy face. Hymns, happy face. Doxology, happy face. Hymn sing. There you go, Ryan. It's a tradition. You did it. Happy face. Okay, just one more. Recognizing the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Happy face. I better just add this. I shouldn't end on this one, but let me say it. Singing. Sad face. Right? Like, I mean, it's just, it's interesting to know the ways that we each have different responses, both to what we think is a tradition and what our emotional reaction is to those sense of tradition. Okay, one more. Church affirmation. Happy face. I'll share the rest of them. Promise. Now, depending on when you arrived in Unitarian Universalism or in this church, you might not think of all these things as traditional, but instead you might see them more as revisions or updates to something even more traditional. The hymnal I read from, 1927, there was nothing in any of the orders of service printed there. This kind of, they're like samples you could use. There's nothing in any of them called a chalice lighting, right? Because the chalice didn't show up in Unitarian, first Unitarianism and then Unitarian Universalism until, anybody know? Yeah, 1941 was the first, but then we didn't even adopt it till later than that. So if we were to look at each of our current practices and patterns, those we name here and those that are so embedded that we need outside eyes to even know they existed, if we took these and tried to trace them back through the ages, what would we discover we have repeated? And what have we reimagined? How are we a co-creation of what has come before? And how are we a beacon of truth for today? One of my biggest surprises from my seminary experience was how much I came to love the Bible, especially the Hebrew Bible. I was actually just one class short from getting a certificate in Bible. Now, my appreciation for the Bible as a Unitarian Universalist felt really confusing. What was wrong with me, I wondered? Was I not actually a UU after all? Now, luckily, before I had a full-on identity crisis, I took my first Unitarian Universalist history course. And there I learned that both Unitarians and Universalists started out loving the Bible, too. In fact, they loved it so much and took it so seriously that they could not abide by the non-biblical conclusions that the Church had made in its positions on the Trinity and predestination. We were opposed those initially because they weren't scripturally sound. Yes, it's true. We have all fallen into relationship with biblical literalists. The further I went in my Bible studies, however, the more I had to puzzle out what the text really meant to me today. Was I just reading it as literature, like any other good dramatic text? Was I looking to it for truth? And if so, how? My Bible professor would say to us, "What does this text tell us about God?" And I was like, "What does that question even mean to me?" So I came to think about these questions in a few different ways. One of them is kind of like how Rebecca Parker concludes her story. That is, the Bible shapes me. It shapes our culture. It shapes our laws, our value systems, our assumptions. It is one of the realities I was born into, especially once I knew about our Unitarian Universalist biblical roots. Now, I might not want it to, but that doesn't change that it does. And so partly I decided I was reading the Bible so that I could really understand and be part of that conversation. But then just as much, I came to see the Bible as a record of a people. The text and the ways 2,000 years worth of people have read that text and thereby wrestled with life's biggest questions. Why are we here? Why is so much of life hard? Where did we come from? Where are we going? Why are people so terrible and beautiful? How should we take care of each other? Or should we? What happens when we die? I came to understand the Bible and the way I read the Bible in the same way I've come to understand this category of tradition we've been exploring this morning more generally. It's like, here's this record of generations passed along across the centuries, person to person, community to community, interpreted and reinterpreted. And in my encounter with this text, I'm encountering all these many centuries of readers asking these questions from their own time and place, the particulars of their age. And so I hold up this tradition in dynamic dialogue with the reality of today and see what that creative interchange might help us understand and create for tomorrow. When we encounter elements of our tradition, we might first react in the ways of Ralph Waldo Emerson, with an impulse to throw out all the old words and rhythms and instead invent language and practices and forms wholly anew, for a new age dawns. People don't speak with these and thous anymore. I mean, why are we singing them in church? Don't even get me started on that doxology, right? Emerson has had a powerful influence on us, playing especially on our liberal religious fascination with the new. You might notice that in the 6 Unitarian Universalist sources, none explicitly reference tradition, and definitely none reference the Unitarian and or Universalist tradition. And yet, if we have ever made a realization like Rebecca Parker's, I've never made any choices at all. My life was given to me. Well, then we might do well to acknowledge there is no divorcing ourselves of our inheritance. It lives in us. It is not just one of our sources, it is our primary source. And so we might ask with a holy curiosity, what are the traditions of this church? What story am I stepping into? It's a good question in other parts of life too, by the way. Like when you're interviewing for a new job, I always think that those poor employees that came right after we'd started fresh, maybe they would have been good if they asked, what story am I stepping into? But also like when you're dating someone or meeting your partner's families or joining a new social group, what story am I stepping into? What's in the walls? Because once we discover these stories, these struggles and patterns and practices, then all of these can be like the way I finally came to read the Bible. A source of wisdom, a source of opportunity, a site for struggle, and a place for new and deeper understanding and a richer faith. Received as a gift, we can begin to interpret these traditions consciously, intentionally for today. The critique made by my friend from seminary, that experience of stepping from growing up UU into our Sunday services, her voices and others like her that remind us we need not simply worship in dead forms, they are important and worth listening to. And yet we can set these yearnings of today in dialogue with our past so that we can create an even more vibrant future. As Rebecca Parker says, we receive who we are, and then we choose who we will become. From these dry bones, we animate new life, casting our great and possible future in relationship with our rich and reverberating past. May it be so, and amen.